This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
You know, she has set out her views and has clarified and so on. It's just outrageous. It is outrageous that people are being as menacing and vile towards Chloe in that way. And there are powers that, of course, can lead to people being prosecuted if they are inciting violence or hatred towards another individual. And these people must stop. They've got to stop. It is just not on in a civilized, open society that someone can say something in a way that they did and that then their daughter gets targeted in such a threatening and offensive way.
Let's get back to call, Clay. Who's next, Mr.
Samantha in Richmond. Hello, Samantha.
Good morning.
Morning.
After 17 years, I've left childminding. This year alone, we've lost over 4,000 childminders, the main reason being unfair inspections, ridiculous amounts of paperwork. The majority of us work for less than the minimum wage and work over 50 hours a week, and we still are one of the cheapest and most flexible forms of childcare. Is it not now true that this government doesn't want childminders anymore?
No, it's not true, Samantha, and I'd be very interested to hear from you what kind of inspection you felt was being too onerous, and indeed also the paperwork that's being too onerous. But as you know, we have done a huge amount to expand the amount of childcare available, make it more affordable. We're introducing, as of next year, as you know, tax-free childcare for working parents across the country. And of course, childminders play a major role in that. But equally, and you'll be the first to acknowledge this, having worked in the sector for 17 years and obviously being very experienced, parents also need confidence that the childminders are good childminders. And the childminders...
Is that by throwing ridiculous amounts of paperwork at us?
Well, there, Samantha, if you know, that's a question of obviously just of degree. If it is ridiculous and it can be shown to be ridiculous, we should always get rid of ridiculous
paperwork. When you have childminders leaving this profession because they cannot keep up with legislation that is constantly being brought in, things changing constantly, we have no support. You've got rid of that. You've now bought independent childminding agencies. When the majority of us have turned around and said to you, we don't want them, we don't get listened to, the inspection process is absolutely ridiculous. All they want to focus on is paperwork. It is not about the children. We do not get treated fairly.
So, Samantha, can you tell me the one change over the last few years that has done most to sort of, you know, obviously upset you about the treatment of childminders?
The ridiculous amount of paperwork we're expected to do.
And that's increased a lot recently?
If I'm working 50 hours a week, my focus needs to be on the children, not writing down something for an Ofsted inspector. Every inspector inspects differently. That is not fair. I don't know what they expect from me from one day to the next when they walk in my door.
I'll tell you what, Samantha, I know it's too in the late for you, because obviously you've by the sounds of it, you left the profession. It'd be really helpful for me to get under the skin of this a bit and to really understand from your point of view what extra paperwork you've had to deal with and whether it's reasonable or not. So, you know, so that if it clearly is unreasonable, I could try and do something about it. Could I get in touch with you separately?
We will take the details, I assure you, and we will pass that over to your office, Deputy Prime Minister. Yep. Samantha, stay on the line. Talk to one of my team. As Mr. Clegg, where do we go to next?
Next caller is Neil in Gatwick. Hello, Neil.
Good morning.
Morning.
If ain't Robinson on the weakest link can manage to have, like, 15 contestants, how is an impartial media not able to manage to get six parties on the stage at any one time on every channel, Mr. Clegg?
This is the leaders' debate, this idea. Stay on the line, Neil. I think we're talking about this bizarre 2-3-5 formation as put forward by the broadcasters.
Well, the broadcasters,
you get
yeah.
cut out of one of them, Clegg.
Oh, I know. Outrage, aren't we? Look, Neil, look, I mean, this is a proposal from the broadcasters.
Yes.
You're right, Neil. They could have come up with a different one and said, look, you know, the more the merrier. Let's just do a whole bunch of debates with everybody. Look,
it's not impartial, Nick. If they're pushing you out and pushing other parties out, it is not impartial,
yeah.
Mr. Clegg. I'm really sorry. I'm very annoyed about
it. I know you are, Neil, but don't get annoyed at me. I'm just a jobbing party leader. I'm not.
Well, you're not going to listen to me. They might listen to you. I'd like to see a thing in the paper tomorrow where your press wing...
I'll tell you what, Neil, can you...
...writing letters to the BBC and the ITV telling them.
Neil, why do you want Mr Clegg on TV so desperately?
Don't
That's what I want to
surprised,
know.
Don't sound so surprised, Nick Ferrari. Neil, if you don't mind, can I get you involved in the Lib Dem negotiating team on this? Because I think you're going to do us proud. But no, look, Neil, the basic point is these leaders' debates have got to happen. I really am looking forward to them. I enjoyed them last time.
Would you sign off on a 2-3-5? The two being Ed Miliband and David Cameron, which many would say is a little unfair because you've been responsible.
Well, 2-3-5. Well, of course. Interested at all? I want a complete spread of every party channel.
Right.
Okay, Neil. There's no doubt you've got the job. No, you are heading the negotiations.
Yes. No. I take your point. And look, of course, everybody's got their own axes to grind, haven't they? Of course, I think it's not right to have the government's record, basically put under scrutiny in one of these debates and not have one whole half of the government there. So, of course, I don't think that's right. And then other parties have also got their complaints. At the end of the day, a decision needs to be made. And I want, the last thing I want is for all this argy-bargy between the parties to be used as an alibi by any particularly the larger political parties to somehow kind of wriggle out of having these debates altogether, because that would be cheating the British people. I think the British people like the fact, and you clearly do, Neil, you like the idea of having all of us up there, having to kind of speak for ourselves, having to kind of do battle, if you like, on through these leaders' debates, so that you can make up your own minds. And that's the danger, is that people come up with ever more exotic reasons why they don't like this or don't like that, and then you end up with nothing. And that's what I, absolutely don't want to happen.
When Paddy Ashdown says, quotes, "I know exactly what Cameron will do. He'll say, we'll do it, but the Greens have got to be in it. He'll try to make a mess."
Yeah.
How do you respond to what Paddy Ashdown says?
Well, no, I mean, look, Paddy's clearly right. If you are the occupant of number 10 and you've got all the kind of advantages of being able to do all that stuff, from the steps of number 10 and the rest of it, which the rest of us can't, you don't have much of an incentive, do you, to suddenly kind of operate in the same level as everybody else. So it's just a sort of basic rule of politics, I think, that if
so
you are
will
the incumbent
try,
prime,
Mr Cameron will try and make
well, they clearly are. The Conservatives have come up with a shifting array, menu of excuses about why they don't like the leaders' debate, but they cannot be allowed to get away with it. They've got to come and, be held to account. I'm prepared to be held to account as Deputy Prime Minister in all the debates, as Neil suggests, not least for what we've done in government. I'm very proud of a lot of the things we've done in government, and I do think it's important that everybody is held to account on the same basis.
Now, you've got a busy agenda up in the north, I know. Can we try one more question? Have you got one more?
Yes, 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 yes. Jerry in Enfield. Hello, Jerry.
Hello, good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
I have a question for Mr Clegg. Mr Clegg, will you be supporting the Home Secretary in her plans to review the police bail procedures?
Yes.
No,
though it's something I've called for in the past. I think there is a real, there's a real issue, isn't there, when you've seen these high-profile cases, but, of course, many other cases which don't get reported, of people basically kept in this kind of limbo, legal limbo, for a very, very long time. That's not the purpose for which bail was originally designed. Bail was there so that someone could go about their daily business, but for a relatively short period of time, nonetheless allow the police to marshal the evidence they need, and then obviously, proceed with charges and prosecution in a way that they need to. It was never designed to have someone basically hanging around for a year and a half before the police decide what to do. And I think it's right that that the Home Office is looking at this now.
And one final question or point from me before I let you go, Deputy Prime Minister. You talk often, and probably quite rightly, about the many achievements that you've had in government. One thing from my understanding that you've yet to achieve, or I might be wrong, is that you haven't quit smoking. Do you ever have a cigarette in the park?
I you're right to say, Mr. Ferrari, it's an ongoing process, this weaning myself off off cigarette. I'm not a sort of heavy smoker by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, what are we
but
doing
I do have the occasional one,
day,
but I don't smoke in parks as it happens. But I have to say to you, I don't. This proposal that I think you're referring to is from Lord Darzai,
yes,
who's produced a report for Boris Johnson. And on this, hallelujah, get the drum roll out, I actually agree with Boris Johnson. I don't think it makes any sense, really, to say, the law is going to you can smoke on that street corner, but you can't smoke on that in that uh, in that you know that town square, or you can smoke in that part but not in that part. I just don't understand how that would work. But more than that, I kind of think, at the end of the day, if people want to make smoking illegal altogether, then they should make that case. But this kind of trying to make it illegal by a thousand cuts just seems to me, you know, if Lord Darzai wants to say, look, we should just make tobacco illegal altogether, then let's have the debate. It's not one I would support. Mm. But I think sort of saying, well, it's going to be illegal in that part of our shared public space, but not in that part, it just doesn't seem to me to make much sense.
And
it's a bit too... No, very, very little. Very little indeed.
Well, how many in a week? Do you get through a packet a week?
No.
You don't get through a packet a week?
I'm not going to get drawn into this conversation. Okay. I'll be running out of time already.
We are. Now, in a sentence, what are you doing up north, Deputy Prime Minister? Tell the listeners.
Actually, what I'm doing, which is exciting, which doesn't happen very often. As you can imagine, in Whitehall,
meeting Lib Dem voters.
No. Well, yes.
Get up here quick, Nick.
Don't be facetious. I am doing that, but I'm also doing something which I was going to, which I hope you'd be interested in, is that I chair, as you can imagine, Deputy Prime Minister, lots of committee meetings of cabinet ministers and of ministers in Whitehall, and one of the ones that I do is a committee where we look at how we can promote local growth, not least in parts of the north, so that we can help deal with this north-south divide. And I thought, well, let's have that meeting in the north rather than constantly having these meetings in the south about the north. And it's part and parcel also of something that I launched over the summer called Northern Futures, where I'm inviting, and we've got 8 open days for open night where people can come with their ideas in various locations across the north of England today, where people can come up with their own proposals about how we can deal with this terrible north-south divide so that the north can stand on its own two feet and rival London and the south-east in the decades to come in terms of economic prosperity and jobs and dynamism.
Well, good luck with that and the colleagues who are working with you. Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg, thank you indeed. So, of course, LBC is a national station, so we wish you nothing but good fortune with that. This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC. He's the top-earning comic at the moment.
Toasters are reviewed on Amazon. Who are these people? Who are these people? You want to buy a toaster, you go online, you start reading people's reviews on toasters. Who in their right mind goes home and does toast? Are they to write the review on the toaster? Settings 2 to 6 are an embarrassment.
Michael McIntyre, but now he says he's been left heartbroken after his stepmother publicly revealed his father committed suicide. In 1993, after a downturn in his career, McIntyre's father Cameron, who was also a comic, shot himself in the head in a Hollywood apartment block. He was just 55. McIntyre was 17 at the time and was told his father had died of a heart attack after his stepmother Holly decided to shield him from the truth. In 2010, when he was approached by the BBC's series Who Do You Think You Are, she realised she would have to come clean. She's now spoken publicly of what they went through. Quotes, if Michael hadn't become famous, the truth would never have come out. But I knew the researchers would find the death certificate. I had to come clean. That was the hardest phone call of my life. McIntyre said yesterday, I'm heartbroken. My stepmother has chosen to share painful and personal information publicly. So there's yet another family rift. I sense this is going to probably be some tough listening for some of you, and I do apologise, particularly if your lives have been touched in any way by suicide. But is it the ultimate taboo, the ultimate secret, the ultimate dark secret lurking in the family closet that you just can't share? Someone within your family committed suicide. If it is, and you can talk about it, fantastic. If it is and you find it difficult to talk about it, we have got a list of organisations that can help. It must be desperately, desperately difficult. But what now for Michael McIntyre, particularly as he now knows that we all know, which I suppose not that it matters in the slightest, it doesn't alter my view of him. I happen to think he's an extremely funny man. I don't think any the less of him at all. His father was obviously in a hideous place. Let's speak with Stephen Habgood, who's Chair of Trustees for Papyrus, a charity involved in preventing suicide, who joins me now.
Good morning. Hello.
Morning, sir. What got you involved in this charity?
Hello. Well, we're a charity which is focused on preventing young suicide, and so you know we do a lot of work around trying to reduce stigma and making people more aware of the very high number of young people who take their life each year from suicide.
I heard a statistic a few weeks ago. I can't remember the exact age range. I think it's late teens through mid-20s for males. Yeah. It's a horrific number, isn't it?
Oh, it is, yeah. 1,600 up to the age of 34. It's the biggest...
Sorry, is that per annum, sir? 1,600?
1,600, yes. The biggest single killer of young people up to the age of 34.
Oh.
And I think many people don't realise that, and the majority of those who take their life are young men, 75% are young men. So it is a fact, a feature of our life. And I mean, I can really sympathise with Michael, but I can understand where his mother was coming from as well. There is a huge taboo around suicide. People are very reluctant to want to admit that, you know, when my son took his own life a few years ago, in 2009, the first thing I felt, it reflected on me as a parent.
Right.
And so, you know, I know parents who've lost their children to suicide and have not told work colleagues. You know,
hang on. What happens when they say, "How's young Charlie?" or whatever it might be?
Well, they may say they lost their child. But
oh, I see. I see.
Or they may not even say. You know, I think they feel, and that's what we're trying to do, is to address that stigma around suicide, which is getting people.
Do you mind if I ask you a couple of questions? You obviously don't have to answer. May I ask how old your son was when he took his life?
He was 26.
He was 26, so he's right in this age bracket you're working with. How have you... What is it, then, that you've managed to turn this... I hate the expression, into a positive experience, but into a learning experience. What have you... How have you been able to do that?
Yeah, I think... I'm the prison governor for 30 years, I never lost anyone to suicide, and then, you know, when I get to be a senior governor, I lose my own son to suicide.
Oh, that is horrific, Mr. Hapgood.
It was a dreadful sort of blow. He texted me to say he loved me and he was sorry, and then he took his life.
Oh, for the love of God.
And so I was kind of really devastated for some months. I wasn't going to work or whatever, and I decided after that I needed to do something to make some sense out of this loss. And so I became involved with Papyrus and took very early retirement from the prison service, and now I'm chairman of Papyrus. And so,
are you?
At least when I'm engaged in doing things like this and talking, getting young people to open up and talk about how they feel, getting people to talk about suicide, at least I think I'm making some positive sense out of my son's death.
So did I hear you correctly? He actually texted you shortly prior to him taking...
Yes, he did, yeah.
Mr. Hapgood, how on earth did you cope with that?
Well, I didn't for a long time, and I think many people don't cope. And it reflects on you. You feel bad as a parent. You feel, you know, and that's why Mrs. McIntyre did what she did. I'm sure she felt this reflected on her as a partner. You know, that her husband would rather not be here than my son would rather be dead. I mean, if he'd died in action, or if he'd been died of an illness or a road accident, I could have made sense of that. But the fact that he didn't want to be here is a really difficult thing to get your head around. Mm. And so I understand why she would have kept that secret, and of course forced to disclose it when she's part of a television programme which is going to talk about his family history.
So what advice would you give to both people involved in this, both to Mr. McIntyre and to stepmum? Is time a great healer, Mr. Hapgood?
I think it is. I think that you know, we have to be open about suicide. You use the term committed suicide. It's actually goes back to when suicide was against unlawful, and it was illegal to commit suicide in 1961. That changed.
Right.
We still have a hangover, and we still say committed suicide rather than completed suicide.
Right.
So we still feel that it's something that is something we shouldn't talk about, and something we should hide. But we need to be open about this. We need to accept that people get in such a desperate place that they take their life. My son was in such an awful state of mind that he took his life. I've got to try to understand how he felt and how awful it was for him.
Yes. And do you mind if I ask, was it professional problems for you?
I think that, you know, what we always want to do is to say it was this or it was that. And I think for many people there's a raft of reasons. It may be, you know, that they're struggling with money, struggling with relationships, changing, going to university, you know, coping with all those kind of things, plus undiagnosed depression, which may lurk in the background. You know, and there may be some sort of bullying or something happens, which is the trigger. But invariably, there's other things which are a feature my son was, you know, was difficult. He had difficulty with money. He's very good looking. He had lots of girlfriends. But, you know, he had suffered from depression for a long time, and he kept this secret because he was ashamed of how he felt.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of when it happened and he left me a lengthy letter about how he felt, and I understood, you know, that he's been struggling for a long time. And I think that's what Mr. McIntyre, Michael's got to it, appreciate, that his father, you know, did this bit out of desperation. And his mother kept it quiet.
Well, just if I could ask you to respond to this, lastly, this line that the mum gives in this interview, quotes, "I didn't think the children needed the burden of growing up under the shadow of a parent committing," is her words, "a parent committing suicide."
That's right, yes, yeah, and I'm sure that that's what people feel. They feel that this is an awful thing to have to kind of come to terms with, this is an awful thing to live with, and if you can, if you're going to have other belief about someone, then that's better.
It is. Mr. Hapgood, thank you for sharing so much. I won't forget that, the fact that you had a successful career as a prison governor when nobody on your charge committed suicide, then you lost your son when he completed suicide, as you say, and I do take your point on board about that. Stephen Hapgood is Chair of Trustees for Papyrus. Dear, 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 a charity involved in preventing youth suicide. If suicide has touched your life, and I totally respect you might want to change your name, it's not for me to tell you that you've got to come out and be open about it. We can put you anywhere in the country and change your name. Do call the number after. Coping with suicide in the family. That line again. I didn't think the children... This is Mrs... What is her name? It's not Mick McIntyre anymore, but Michael McIntyre's mum. I didn't think the children needed the burden of growing up under the shadow of a parent committing suicide. Maria's in Hampstead. Hello.
Hello, Nick.
Thank you for coming on. Right.
I didn't think I could make this call because it happened to my brother 20 years ago.
Right. I'm so sorry.
And he was staying with me in London, and then he told me he had to go back to France. The last time I saw him was dropping him off at Finchley Road tube station.
Mm.
And then I heard nothing. None of us heard anything.
Mm.
And then I heard by phone that he was on the missing list.
How long ago, sorry, how long a gap between dropping him off at Finchley Road was that then?
About a week or so.
Right. Gosh, terrible.
And then everybody was put on alert to look for him, search for him. I even rang Alistair Stewart, who you probably know.
The ITV newsreader?
Yes. He was one of my neighbours a long time ago.
Oh, I see, right, right.
But at the time, he was doing a programme for missing people.
I remember that.
Yeah, well, I got through to Alistair eventually.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said, "I'll do what I can, Angie, don't..." Ooh, I've just given up my name.
Don't worry,
sorry.
Keep going. No one heard it. Keep going. It's fine, don't worry.
But it wasn't until 3.5 weeks later that a hunter found him in France, in Carn, in the forest.
Crikey. And he'd taken his life?
Yes.
And I don't know whether you have siblings, other siblings, or you have children, or nephews, or nieces?
Nothing. He was my only mum.
He was your only member of your family?
Yeah. My father rang up and told me. And then to discover... Because I just froze.
Of course you
did. I couldn't do anything.
No, of course not, love. I understand. But
my dad hadn't told anybody.
Right.
And when I met a friend of my father's, they said, "What's wrong?" And I said, "Hasn't my father told you?" He said, "No." And he still won't talk about it to this day.
Right. So it is... It is very much as we hear, then. It's something that families can't talk about.
Well, I talk about it, but no one else does.
Right.
And instead of taking me to France, he took my stepmother.
Right. This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC. Some other figures for you now. Women are losing their life expectancy lead over men. Work stress, drinking, smoking are taking an increasing toll on ladies' health, so says the ONS, Office for National Statistics. Now, if we go back to 1963, which is, what, a whisker over 50 years ago, men were twice as likely to die early as women. Last year, however, the increased risk fell to 1.5 times, and the life expectancy gap has fallen from 6 years to fewer than 4. The study is the first official recognition. Women who've abandoned the domestic lives of their grandmas now face the same shorter lifespans of men. There we are, ladies. Is this the trade-off you're going to have to endure? Higher premature death rates for women were most marked in the 55 to 69 age group, the paper has said. Male health has improved. Men are smoking less and drinking less, and also fewer are employed in dangerous jobs in industrial environments. Women, however, are smoking more and drinking more and going to work, and they're not. Now, this is intriguing. In some instances, they're not as well equipped to process stress. Now, I'm surprised to hear that, because women are by nature talkers, and they're probably, I bet you now, if you're a woman, you'll have a larger circle of friends than most blokes you know have. Women have a far bigger circle of friends than most blokes. Most blokes. Not always. And it's through that circle of friends, of course, that they can process all the problems. Whereas typically what a bloke will do is that they will perhaps want to have one or two close mates, or they'll go down the pub, or whatever they'll do, and they'll just have a drink. So what's causing this? Imogen Thompson is with Mothers at Home Matter. You can read some of her comments in one of the newspapers today. The Daily Mail joins me now. Why are women then suffering? Why are their numbers coming down in this fashion, would you say? Good morning.
Well, I think women do have an awful lot of pressure at the moment.
Don't men? Don't men?
Oh, absolutely. I think everybody's in a position at the moment where the only reward they get is from being economically active.
Yeah.
And therefore, you know, from an economic point of view and a social point of view, everybody's really sort of being pushed into the workplace without, you know, because there's no alternative, really.
Mm.
Obviously, everybody's feeling the strain of the economic climate at the moment. And also, I think what's troubling is that let's take a step back from that and look at why are they struggling? It's housing costs, it's food costs. And even all the charities that are involved with, you know, things like the Joseph Rowntree Foundation recently last year published a report saying that the only way out of poverty really is for single income families. For the other parent, which is usually the mum who wants to stay at home for a few years while the children are young, is to go back into the workplace. And we would just say, well, actually, let's try and seek an alternative to this, because that's not always the right solution for every single family.
So what are some of the other solutions out there then, would you say?
Well, some of the other solutions is a fairer family taxation policy. Instead of having to push both parents into work and therefore they have to pay for childcare, which is also another large cost that people find very stressful to, you know, to meet their ends. Basically, we would look at, you know, saying, well, like other countries, why don't we have a family-friendly taxation system where all...
Sorry, how does that stop a woman from drinking and smoking?
Well, I can't comment on that.
Why?
Well, I think everybody deals with their own stress.
But you're with Mothers at Home Matter. I would imagine that some poor mums who maybe are struggling with bringing up children and perhaps not as much in money coming in either through themselves and their husbands or their husbands, they probably do have the odd drink. So it's very pertinent to your clients, isn't it?
Well, yes. I mean, absolutely. I think everybody deals with stress in their own way. I mean, it's not always going to be that way, but I think stress is just such a big thing at the moment that everybody's feeling very, very time reduced. Time, you know, time is very tricky for everybody. You know, and I think when you don't have time, you don't have enough money. You can't put food on the table. You know, everybody takes it in a different way.
Yes. Lastly, the smoking. Women taking up smoking, particularly young women taking up smoking. One of the largest groups. I wonder why that is. Because we couldn't have more of an education program warning people about the dangers, could we?
Yeah, I mean, I can't comment on why people would take up smoking, but I think it's just, again, the stresses of family life, and families are just under so much stress at the moment in terms of, you know, finances, that, you know, some people don't have extended family to turn to, they don't have, you know, the community bonds are being lost because everybody's being forced out to work, there's no one in you know, we're looking at empty houses in a street, you don't have a friendly neighbour to go to talk to anymore.
And that is the way it breaks down. Imogen Thompson, thank you, you're with Mothers at Home Matter. Let's take some calls on this. Steve's in Tunbridge Wells. What's causing this, Steve, in your view?
Hi there, Nick.
Hello.
Yeah, in my opinion, I think it's... More of a case of, since women have joined the workforce, so to speak, they've taken on the same sort of task as men have. And traditionally, men were essentially stressed out after work, but now, since they're also experiencing the same, I think it's the whole build-up of work life.
Yes.
I was just actually While you're talking to the lady, I was thinking,
yes.
Perhaps one of the reasons is maybe women don't know how to de-stress like men can. I'll give you an example of myself and my wife.
How do you de-stress?
Sorry?
I was wondering how you de-stressed.
I can go home.
Yeah.
And I can sit on the sofa and I can think of absolutely nothing. As in, for I'll just laze about and really try and calm myself down. Whereas my wife, for example, she can come home and she can see that maybe the sitting room is untidy, so she wouldn't just relax. She would have to tidy up before relaxing, kind of thing. So in that sense, I see maybe women just are not good at de-stressing, which is...
Well, maybe you should get up and do the dishes.
Well, maybe...
Instead of sitting there doing nothing, sitting on the sofa having blissful thoughts like some great pontificating Buddha, you should get up there and go and wash the dishes.
Maybe we should leave the house a bit dirty for a while and do the dishes when we're...
Isn't that right?
...de-stressed.
What is it with women and cleanliness? What's that all about?
No, that's the million-pound question.
It is a million-pound question. Always loading the dishwashers all day long, never happier. Steve, thank you. We'll come back to more views on this. And back to Judy Finnegan. So many of you saying that Judy actually was broadly right in the comments she was making about that football player caught up in the rape case. More on that after this.
Nick Full BC.
The football player convicted of rape 2 years ago, or in 2012, comes out of jail within days. Unsurprisingly, the jail refused to specify exactly what day. He played for Sheffield United. He was worth £3 million prior to his jailing, so he's obviously quite good at kicking a ball or a ball around. Does he get his job back? Bear in mind, if we were talking about a bus driver, you probably wouldn't know any the wise. Actually, he probably wouldn't get it back, haven't you, because he deals with people. I wonder what sort of job he could do. A call centre worker. You wouldn't worry too much, would you? We're going to call this woman Laura in Reading. You're on the radio. Hello.
Hi. This footballer who's done what he's done, I understand why you're asking the question, but I have recently had reason to read through what we call an athlete's agreement.
Oh, yes.
And there is an awful lot in there about bringing your club or your sport into disrepute.
Oh, right, yep. Mm-hmm.
Now, if you pursue excellence in a sport to the level that you are a household name, you know that's what's going to happen. And you know that you carry the reputation of the sport and your club around with you. Therefore, I feel he has put his club's name in disrepute. I think he has. And therefore, he must have signed one of these documents, because you even have these at quite low
levels. Well, he's lost his shot. It's what happens when he comes out. He's done his time. Are you saying he could never be a football player again?
I don't think that a club should sign up someone who has brought the sport into disrepute, and I don't think that...
So he never works again?
Well, not as a footballer.
Well, that's what he was trained to do. That's what he's wanted to do all his life. I mean, all right, he plays for Sheffield United. It's not exactly AC Milan, but it's still pretty good. I don't know what sort of money he's putting down. He's got to be pretty competent at it. He's done his time. He's been convicted, but you're saying you can't get your job back.
I don't think he should be able to get his job back. I don't think a club should sign him up on the ground that he has signed and agreed.
So he's punished for life?
He would be in most other sports. If I did something within my sport like that, I'd lose my job for life. Yeah,
right.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. There's no coming back from it. If he had, let's say he'd done it to another football player, he was gay and he'd had it.
Well, hang on. We are getting a long way off, but go on.
But that would have an impact as well. So, there was a lot of fuss recently about a footballer who kept his sexuality as a secret. Why should he have to do that? And this guy, who has openly been done for rape, be allowed to just walk back in?
Okay. Laura, thank you. I know it's not your name.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Smoking should be outlawed in public parks, so the chief medical officer said last night. Sally Davis says a ban is needed to stop children being set a bad example. Campaigners immediately denounced this as an attack on personal liberties. They said it could be the start of a slippery slope. I love that expression. Plans are in a report commissioned by London Mayor Boris Johnson and written by Lord Darzi, a surgeon and former Labour minister. He calls for the mayor to use his powers as London mayor to ensure 20,000 acres in parks in London go smoke-free. The ban would even extend to Trafalgar Square and possibly become a nationwide campaign, a blueprint for the whole of the country. Well, can't wait, won't wait. So we decided to send our LBC reporter Lorraine Horgan to, I think it's St James Park, who joins me now. Have you been telling people to put that light out, Lorraine? Good morning.
Yes, I have. So where are smokers supposed to go? We've already got a ban in restaurants, in pubs and hotels, and now there's calls for no more smoking in areas around bus stops, famous landmarks like Trafalgar and Parliament Square and London's Park. So I went along to St James's to interrupt a few people having their morning cigarette. I'm really sorry, but I've got a massive issue with people smoking in parks. Do you mind putting that out?
It's supposed to be a free country, and it's fresh air, so no.
Well, it was fresh air until you lit up.
Well, walk away from me then.
Well, I'm in a park, and it's supposed to be about fresh
air. I'll walk away from you then.
Well, good, but why can't you just go somewhere else? Why does it have to be a park?
Because it doesn't have to be a park at all. It's the outside. It could be anywhere I want. I just happen to be in a park.
Do you have any idea how disgusting that is? We're in a park. Can you please put it out?
It is a public place, so, you know, it's not like a closed room or something. So.
Yeah, but I don't want to inhale your smoke.
I appreciate that, but nonetheless, it is a public place.
I'd like to sit down on this bench next to you, and I don't particularly like filthy, dirty smoke.
Okay, that's fine. Okay, please, feel free. That's great, but I'm sorry, but there's plenty of other benches around if you need clean air.
I like this bench.
Okay. Please, sit down.
But I don't think you're being very considerate. You're sitting here smoking a cigarette. I don't want to breathe in that.
Okay, all right. I'm sorry. There's plenty of other fresh air around, but I just need this for now. I've got problems at home and stuff like that, and I just need a cigarette before I go to work.
Sorry, you're in a park. Do you really have to smoke?
Well, yeah, I'm on my way to work. It's my morning cigarette.
Yeah, but I'm on my way to work, and I don't want a morning cigarette.
Yeah, but we're in an open space, which is not banned in public. And I understand you can't smoke in pubs, which is closed and you can breathe it in, but you're outside where there's fresh air and it's a big park.
There isn't really fresh air, though, is there, if you're going to have a cigarette?
Yeah, but it's a big park.
I know it's
a
big park, but
I'm... So I could move, or you could move. I don't see what the problem is.
Well, the problem is, I'm not a smoker. You're not supposed to smoke in parks, surely because it's about fresh air. So why do I have to endure your smoke? Why do you want to be in a park in the fresh air if you're going to have a cigarette?
Because I need a cigarette, because I'm addicted to nicotine.
That's your problem.
That's Lorraine Horgan, reporting from St James Park. You should see her if you don't clean away your dirty cutlery in the canteen. She really kicks off then. Great work there by Lorraine. But should we be smoke-free in our parks? Andrew Hayes is formerly director of Smoke Free London. So I think I've probably got an idea which side of the fence you're going to come down on, Mr Hayes, but let's confirm it. You're for putting out those cigarettes, are you, Mr Hayes?
Yes, I am. I've only heard the news this morning, and I welcome it, of course.
Why can't I? I don't happen to be a smoker, but if I am, why can't I have a cigarette as I walk through the park?
Well, the intention, I guess, behind the proposal is to try and reduce the example of adult smoking in front of children, as well as trying to improve the atmosphere. The smoke-free legislation that was introduced in 2007 has made a marvellous improvement in indoor atmospheres, and this is an extension of that trend, so to speak, to denormalise smoking.
Where will I be allowed to smoke?
You don't need to smoke, Nick. It's not a natural human function.
But some,
absolutely unnecessary.
Some people enjoy it.
Then they must enjoy it in the privacy of their own homes.
Well, obviously, if they've got children, they can't do that, so they can go in their back gardens, presumably.
If they have gardens, yes.
Yeah, okay. But then if I've got a neighbour who doesn't like smoke coming across, presumably I can't smoke in my own back garden if I can't smoke in a park.
It is a problem. It's one that I've experienced myself, and I can understand the irritation of non-smokers to be subjected to smoke, which is harmful as well as unpleasant.
Where have you been subjected? You had a neighbour who smoked heavily, did you?
Yes.
How was that for you? What did that mean for you in your daily life?
It was very unpleasant, and I asked several times that it should be stopped. Eventually, that particular neighbour moved. That was the only way it was resolved.
Why can't you live and let live?
As I said earlier, smoking is not a natural human function. It's a choice that people make, inevitably when they're teenagers. I think we need to remember that nobody starts smoking beyond the age of 20. They've been hooked into smoking by the tobacco.
Sorry. People do start smoking after the age of 20. Yes. I'm sure the proportions are far greater, but to say no one smokes after the age of 20 is simply wrong.
Scarcely anyone starts to smoke beyond the age of 20. It's people who are children or teenagers who are hooked into it.
It's not illegal, lastly, Mr.
Then it's no longer a choice. It's an addiction.
It's no longer... It's not illegal, Mr. Hayes.
And it's not illegal, no. I mean, many of us wish it were, but it isn't, and we have to live with that.
You would make smoking illegal?
We couldn't do that. I wish it were possible, but it's not.
Why would you... So something that gives some people solace, falsely, of course, but they think they're getting solace and comfort, why would you seek to ban it?
It's not a natural, necessary human function, and...
Well, neither cycling, but people enjoy it.
People may enjoy it, but they do so because they're hooked, because it's an addiction, and the consequences of it, for London, I'm no longer directly involved, but when I was 3 years ago, 10,000 people dying each year as a direct result of their smoking.
Well, sadly, people down the roads.
That we can prevent by pushing tobacco control.
Sadly, people are knocked down by cars. Are you going to ban motor cars as well?
No.
Because that's not a natural human function.
Well, it's no, it's not.
Yeah, what about, just out of interest, would you ban alcohol? Just out of interest, would you ban alcohol?
No.
Why is that, then?
Because people can use alcohol in moderation and they don't suffer any consequences of it. It's only alcohol in excess.
But someone who has a cigarette a day, one cigarette a day...
I'm afraid you're hooked, then.
But you're not hooked if you have one drink of beer a day?
No, the consequence of smoking, even if you smoke in moderation, is ill health, a shortened life and possibly a painful death, which can be avoided.
I'm grateful for your input. Thank you, Andrew Hayes, formerly Director of Smoke Free London. Dave Atherton chairs Freedom to Choose. Mr. Atherton, what do you make of what you're hearing so far?
Oh, I mean, wasn't Andrew Hayes a most deeply unpleasant person?
Well, his views, perhaps. Certainly not as a person.
His views were deeply unpleasant.
His views.
And what a bigot. That's basically, he sets the bar for tobacco control and all the nanny status of the world. And that's the kind of thing us smokers put up with day in, day out. Sort of the bullying, the denormalisation.
Where do you stand, Mr. Atherton? Were you supportive of banning them in restaurants and pubs?
No, that's also a matter of a discretion of the owner, the person who owns that pub or restaurant.
You don't think pubs have been made much more enjoyable experiences because they're smoke-free?
Well, if you find one that's open, since the smoking ban's come in, 14,000 pubs have closed net, and something like 150,000 people have been made unemployed as a result of the smoking ban. So if you call that a success, the smoking ban, call it a success.
Dave Atherton, thank you. You chair Freedom to Choose. There's been a 12-year crackdown on our smoking habit. We mentioned, of course, the smoking ban in public places like pubs. That was 2007. Tobacco advertising was banned back in 2002. What year were tobacco vending machines banned? Have a guess. What year? I'll tell you after this.
Nick Ferrari at LBC.
To smoke in public parks or not to smoke in public parks. Tony's in Harlow. What do you say, Tony?
Oh, I don't talk about smoking.
I'm going to talk about smoking.
No, it's nearly killed me. What I mean is nearly killed me. I smoked when I was 14. I'm 67. 5 years ago, I had a heart problem, and I stopped smoking from that day. And I haven't smoked. And I'll tell you what, my daughter and son go out in the garden for a cigarette. I sit indoors. Two doors are shut, and I've got a little window open to let the air in. And I'll tell you what, it's horrible. I can smell it from outside. It's disgusting.
Well, yes, I can imagine, and I'm
not
delighted.
Nick.
I'm delighted your health is improving, but I don't happen to be a smoker. But if someone wants to walk through Greenwich Park, and I don't have any problem.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's up to them then. What about the people who have bad hearts and that? And you know, I mean, what do we do then?
Well, come on, man. And unless you're literally embracing that person who's smoking.
No, I know what you mean. But I think it's disgusting habit anyway. It makes you smell, your hair's yellow, your hair goes yellow, your nails are all bad. And
That's fine. So don't do it in your house. I'm glad your health has improved, but and if you don't want people smoking in your back garden, but don't restrict it in part. The next thing will be you're not allowed to smoke on the pavement. The next thing will be we'll actually chase people down into their homes. It is not illegal.
No, I don't believe in that. I don't say that. What I'm saying is I'm just saying how unhealthy it is. It's terrible. These people don't realise that it will catch them up in the end.
Well, sadly, you're right. No one's health is improved by a cigarette, and most people, many people, have very serious health issues as a result. Thank you for that. Clive in Nottingham. What do you say, Clive?
Hi, Nick. Yeah, it's a kind of a extension of the... I called him a fag fascist earlier on in my head, actually. The guy that was on trying to ban cigarettes.
Mm.
I'm a non-smoker, but I think we should still allow cigarettes. I think it's a bit unreasonable, because prohibition didn't stop alcohol in the States back in the early part of the last century. But your argument about alcohol is a little bit skewed because when I drink a glass of wine or a beer, I'm not imposing my wine on anybody else, whereas a smoker would impose his smoke.
Not in a park. Well, I don't believe they would in a park.
No, in a park. I'm not against that. I think that's quite unreasonable. Mm. But the other thing I haven't picked up on during this conversation is the litter that smokers proliferate when they enjoy their habit. Those fag butts in that park wouldn't necessarily end up in a bin, would they?
Well, that is a fair point, but of course there are now special bins or something where you can stub out the cigarette and you're meant to put them in. And again, just because I will argue a small minority of people don't clear up after themselves, it doesn't mean you should prohibit all of them. A very small minority of people don't clean up after their dogs in a park. To ban all people who walk dogs who do clean up after the dog would be totally unfair. I'm Nick Ferrari. You've been listening to the highlights of my week at breakfast on LBC. I'm back on Monday leading Britain's conversation with the big breaking stories of the day, along with regular travel updates. Have a great weekend and stay safe. This is LBC.